Hosea 1, 1 through 11. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord." So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, "Call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." She conceived again and bore a daughter. And the Lord said to him, "Call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword, or by war or by horses or by horsemen." When she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, "Call his name Not My People, for you are not my people and I am not your God. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' it shall be said to them, 'Children of the living God.' And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head. And they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel." This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
Recently, I was sitting on the couch in my house having a conversation with my wife. And I'll tell you up front, I got permission to share this conversation. If you're thinking, boy, he's going to get in trouble later, I got permission. While we were talking, she said, "I feel bad about something that I said." And I said, "Oh, well, what did you say?" And she shared it with me, and I thought, that doesn't sound so bad to me. Why do you feel bad about that? And she said, just didn't feel like the right time or the right place to share it. And I thought, okay. I know there's times when I'm feeling the weight of guilt about something, and I'll share it with someone, and they don't think it's a big deal, but it actually still is to me. I'm still trying to process it. And usually the mistake I make at this point is I try to help her process it quicker. So I start coming with a whole bunch of truth and all of this truth that she already knows. So what we did this time instead, since that usually doesn't work, is we just prayed. And before we prayed, I asked her, "Have you had a chance to confess it to the Lord?" And she said, "I have. And I'm still feeling this." And so I said, "Well, let's just pray." And so we prayed. And we prayed that God would move in our lives and continue to teach us and help us to see and understand the things we need to see and understand. And we ended our prayer. I don't remember much about the rest of the night, but the next morning we'd got up and I was reading off in one room and she was reading her devotions in another room. And she called me in. And when she called me in to the room she was reading in, she said, "Listen to this." So she's reading Isaiah 1:18, and she was reading it in the NIV, and it says, "Come, let's settle the matter." And even just when she said that line, she's like, "Isn't that so good?" Like, I was so unsettled with this. And here the passage says, "Come, let's settle the matter. Though your sin be like scarlet, I will wash you white as snow. Though it be like crimson, I will make it like wool." And almost got tingles as she's sharing it with me, like, God is so good. And then she said, "And look at what I'm wearing." And to work that day, I was wearing a crimson top and white pants. And I thought, the Lord is so funny. Like, he would never speak to me through clothes, but I wouldn't even notice that as I'm wearing it, but Karen absolutely would. And just his kindness, right, the way he intervenes. By the way, Karen leaned over to me in first service and said, "You do realize that you and Claude and Rich are dressed almost identical. I share that story because we're about to get into Hosea. And in Hosea, there's a lot of judgment. And you can get, like Heather said, stuck in the yuck, right? There's a lot going on here. And as we look into it, I want us all to remember, because we know him, right? Those of us who turn to him and trust him, that he's kind. He's merciful. But not only is he kind and he's merciful, he is miraculous. He does the miraculous. And I'm convinced that we all need the miraculous every day. And we can think of the big miracles, and we should, you know, these things that we just know, like, whoa, look what God did. But it is miraculous how he moves us out of stuckness. There is nothing that I could say to Karen that night that could get her out of this feeling, this weight. But he miraculously intervenes, and he moves us, and he does these sort of miracles all the time. And it's good, because we need them all the time. We're going to look at Hosea today. We're going to land on the miraculous. But before we do, what we've done in the summer reading, as we go through these minor prophets, and last summer also, is we take a look at what we say behind the text, at the text, and then in front of the text. And normally when we say that, you know, if we're behind the text, we mean like, what's the history behind the book? And when we look at the text, we're going to actually look at Hosea and see, what does it say? But we want to land on in front of the text. How does this impact me? Because what Hosea has to say impacts us. And the Apostle Paul is going to pick up on it, and we're going to be reminded again what Hosea has to say, what the Lord says through Hosea and Paul impacts us. So, okay, how about behind the text? Well, we don't have to do too much looking behind the text, because we did it last week with Amos and the week before with Isaiah. And Isaiah and Amos are speaking at a very similar time. They're very close. Amos is first. He comes on the scene. He's probably there for about a year, maybe two. Hosea comes on right after him, and he speaks for 3 decades. The timeline that I'd like to look at, we'll call this the timeline of reality and grief. It's not like Israel hadn't experienced moments of great hope and glory. They had. But at this point, when Hosea is talking, it is almost entirely in the past. That it was the past that had Abraham, right? When I think when Rich went through it, we put up a 2000 BC there, like way past. When Hosea is talking, we're about 760, and he'll speak right around till 730-ish range. But so he's like 1,300 years, 1,200 years removed from Abraham. He's after David. He's after Joshua has moved into the promised land. He's after Solomon has built the temple and the Lord has descended on the temple. This is all in the past. And what's looming now that Hosea sees is the north falling. That Hosea is getting very close, just like Amos was. He's talking to this northern part of what used to be a united Israel, right? The nation split. That was right after Solomon. Solomon is the height of glory for Israel. Right after Solomon, Israel splits into a north and a south. It's a little confusing because the north is actually called Israel, right? Jerusalem isn't even there. Jerusalem's in the south, which is Judah. Hosea comes along, he's speaking to the northern nation, and he's saying, big problems ahead. Big problems ahead. And the minor prophets, they all do it the same way. When you think of any of the prophets, but especially in the minor prophets, it's like they're good lawyers. They keep pointing back to Moses and the law, and they say, remember this. Yes, what we received from Moses was glorious. God descending on Mount Sinai like a cloud, like fire, speaking to Moses, writing down the law, glorious revelation. But it came with some contingencies. Right now it was obey the law, or there's consequences. And the consequences are judgment. So that Hosea in chapter 6, verse 7, says it pretty straightforward. But like Adam, they transgressed the covenant, the law that Moses brought. Do this and you'll be blessed. Turn from me. There's consequences. There's judgment. And Hosea says, look, you've dealt faithlessly. And as a result, judgment is coming. Assyria is coming. At this point, when Hosea first begins to speak, they're feeling pretty good about themselves. They're not really listening to Hosea. There actually is never this big revival that happens as a result of Hosea's preaching and prophesying. But the reality in Hosea is judgment. Judgment is the reality in Hosea. You have broken the law, and there's consequences. Just like you were warned, and the Assyrians are coming. Now, when we read chapter 1, it gets a little complicated, right? I mean, in general, when we're reading names in the Old Testament, it gets complicated. We have trouble even pronouncing them. But in this case, it's even a little bit more complicated. Because you read these names, and Hosea's assuming that you know them, because there's history tied up in them. So that when Hosea names the son Jezreel, that's supposed to mean something to the Israel, to the readers. And it did mean something to the Israelites. And when he mentions the house of Jehu is going to be judged, that meant something to them. Jezreel, well, it's a child's name, but originally it's not the name of a person. It's a place. And if you want to see what went down in Jezreel, you can later go back and read 2 Kings chapters 9 and 10. But what happened in Jezreel is there was a king who was a descendant of Ahab. Ahab is like the worst king. He's the worst. And he's married to Jezebel. And if there's anyone worse than Ahab, it's Jezebel. By the way, just this week, I watched Moby Dick. It was like an old video, old movie it was on. And, you know, the captain's name is Ahab. And as Ishmael signs up to go on the boat, he says, Ahab? You mean like the name of the evil king, Ahab? And I thought, wow, you could not make that quick Bible reference these days. Like, but yeah, that's it. Ahab was the worst of the worst. And his descendant is on the throne. Ahab's dead, but his son is ruling. And he's injured, and he's hanging out in Jezreel. This is probably 100 years before Hosea. Okay, but what happened in those 100 years prior is a prophet came to Jehu, who was not king at the time, and the prophet said, go wipe out all of Ahab's descendants. I'm going to make you king. Go wipe out all of Ahab's descendants. And so Jehu does that. He goes to Jezreel. He wipes out the king. He goes on to wipe out all of Ahab's descendants. But here's what else he does. He kills the king of Judah. He kills some of the friends of the king of Judah. He kills a whole bunch of other people all through 2 Kings chapter 9 and 10. He goes much further than what he was told to do. That he was told to go carry out judgment against Ahab and his house. And he just took this authority, and when he got it, he just went on slaughtering. And Jehu's descendants stay on the throne for years. In fact, almost 100 years later, when Hosea's speaking to Israel, a descendant of Jehu is still on the throne. Jeroboam, There was another Jeroboam, but this Jeroboam that you read about in Hosea 1, he's a descendant of Jehu. And so when the message comes, the house of Jehu will be judged for what went down at Jezreel. That current king is going to be judged. And the whole house of Israel, we're told. Hosea is announcing judgment. Judgment is the reality in Hosea. Right? We said with all the minor prophets, we're going to see this reality, grief, hope. And the reality is you are guilty and judgment's coming on the whole house of Jehu and all of the house of Israel. Judgment. I am glad in just a little bit we're going to be moving off the judgment piece. We can see why Heather would call it the yuck that we can get stuck in, right? Who likes to dwell too long on judgment? But I think we have to ask at least a couple questions before we move off judgment. One is that question that we hear a lot, probably in our own heads, I'm sure sometimes in our own heads, and we definitely hear it outside around us, within the church and outside of the church, which is, how can God be merciful? How can he be a God who washes our sin from scarlet and makes us white as snow, and at the same time carry out judgment, like what's going to go down when Assyria heads into Israel? How do we put these two together? I want to say this. I have never met anybody who doesn't want judgment, who doesn't need it. Because we all demand justice. We all want justice, which includes judgment. I have never met anybody who thinks Hitler should get away with his crimes. Never. In fact, my experience is, especially living in LA for a while, was that if someone perceived that justice hasn't been done, there might be rioting in the streets. We demand justice. And that's good. It's true. We need justice. We all want justice, and justice includes judgment. Well, then why do we all pull back from it too? And I want to say it's because of this. We've never seen any individual or any government or any ruling body ever do it perfectly. That what we hear Jehu did back in Jezreel back in the day, we think, yep, that's how it goes down. We want to see justice, but when a person gets in charge of carrying out the justice, which will include judgment, inevitably they'll mess it up. They'll let the guilty off, but they'll also go too far and punish the innocent. We've never seen it carried out well. Even in our parenting, we don't know what to do, right? We see something go down and we see our kids do it and we think, there's got to be consequences for that. Okay, fair enough. What are they? And when does mercy step in? Well, I have no idea. But there is one who judges perfectly. There is one who can be counted on to strike this balance of mercy and judgment. And he's the one who says he's going to do it in Hosea. Judgment is the reality in Hosea. And only God can balance this mercy and judgment that's required. Only God can say, for Israel, judgment is right now. And for Judah, they get a little more time. It's going to be about 130 years later, but they're going to get it when the Babylonians come down. And then he's going to carry out judgment on the Babylonians and the Assyrians. Only he can do this. Judgment is the reality. I don't know about you, but I'm ready to move on to hope. Is there any hope in Hosea? And the answer is absolutely yes. And for some of you, this won't be a surprise, but for some of you, it might be that in Hosea, resurrection is the hope. Resurrection is the hope in Hosea. Isn't that interesting? I mean, I read through the Old Testament regularly. It's rare when you, oh, I shouldn't say that. I've read it as if like I'm reading the whole Old Testament once a month or something. But like you stuck my nose in there a little bit. You don't see a lot of resurrection talk, right? Look at this passage in Hosea chapter 6, verse 2. It says, after 2 days, right? So Hosea's been like judgment, judgment, judgment. And then he says this, after 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up that we may live before him. Hosea is saying, yes, judgment's coming, but look, after 2 days, after 3 days, there's going to be a little bit of time. But on the third day, he will raise us up. Really? On the third day, being raised up. The word here, like this was originally written in Hebrew, Hosea was, but it's translated into Greek. The word here is the same word that we get resurrection from. It's anistemi. And it's where we get anastasis, or you know the name Anastasia? That means resurrection, right? This is the word. In fact, when Jesus in Luke chapter 24, verse 7, says this, since the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and on the third day, rise. Same verb, third day, rise. Hosea's saying, look, it's coming. Assyria's coming. There's no like repent and you can avoid it. It's coming. But what he is saying is, there's hope. There's still hope. Stay faithful. Put your eyes on the Lord. Resurrection is the hope in Hosea. Do you remember in John chapter 11? You know that story of Jesus going to the funeral of Lazarus? He's about to go raise Lazarus from the dead, but before he gets there, Martha comes running out, and Jesus says to her, he'll rise again. And she says, I know he will on resurrection day. This is probably one of the verses she's thinking about. There's a day coming, a resurrection, and my hope for my brother and my hope. And Hosea is saying, it's your hope. Resurrection is the hope in Hosea. Unfortunately, they don't really catch it in Israel. That in general, in the days of Hosea, they miss out on. That resurrection is the hope in Hosea, but Israel in general misses it. That what we read in chapter Hosea 13, chapter 13, verse 14, is the Lord says this through Hosea, shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol, from hell? Should I save them from hell? Shall I redeem them from death? O death, where are your plagues? O Sheol, where is your sting? Compassion is hidden from my eyes. That what we see the Lord doing is saying, okay, the Assyrians are coming. Should I save them? I can save them, right? It almost sounds like he might be saying, oh, death, where's your sting? I'm going to rescue you. But we get to the end of this, and the Lord's landed on, it's time for judgment. Compassion's hidden from my eyes. It's almost like he's saying, instead of, oh, death, where is your sting? He's saying, oh, death, it's time. Where is your sting? Bring on the plagues. Bring on the judgment. And Israel is judged. This is not to say that no one in Israel was saved. I want to say Hosea saved. But that in general, the hope of resurrection was missed. And resurrection is the hope in Hosea. But not just for Hosea's day. Resurrection is our hope. And that's why Paul picks up on it in his letter to the Corinthians. Let me read you 1 Corinthians 15, verses 54 and 55. That Paul for sure has Hosea in mind when he writes this. When the perishable puts on the imperishable. He's talking about Resurrection Day, right? Jesus said, a day is coming when all who are in their graves will hear my voice and come out, will rise, resurrected bodies. Like Jesus, he rose in what? A resurrected body. He calls us out. He says, for those who have done good, they'll rise to eternal life. For those who have done evil, they rise to be condemned. That's the day when the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on immortality. Then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? Resurrection is our hope too. Paul was writing to a church that had begun to deny in some circles the resurrection. And he said, no, no, no. This has been taught from the beginning. Jesus was buried and he rose from the dead on the third day. You can believe, and resurrection is your hope too. The order that we keep seeing in the minor prophets is this reality, grief, hope. I want to say that we experience this same process, this same order, all the time, constantly. I want to put up a chart for you that this is what it looks like, that there will, the truth is that reality, we're going to move into grief. But when we're faithful, it's the resurrection that allows us to face reality and move through the grief with hope. That if we deny Christ, we move into this grief with no answers. We almost have to deny reality, right? Like, my sin's not that bad, I'm going to be fine. The reality is, all of us make mistakes, and the guilt is crushing. Even if we try to deny it, it's crushing. That in a small way, what Karen experienced that morning as she read Isaiah 1:18 and realized that, yes, again for her, her sins are washed. She's white as snow. And she's moving from this reality of, I shouldn't have said that. At least not then. Not like that. And she's moving through this grief, and she's experienced forgiveness, new life, resurrection. I have a friend who about, I don't know, last month or two, she's a cancer survivor. But it came back, and it came back strong. Tumors all over her body. She had an appointment lined up with a specialist down at Duke. But before she got there, a group of us got together and we prayed with her. We talked with her and then we prayed with her. And as we were talking with her, you know, such a weird feeling, right? You're looking at this friend of yours who appears so healthy and she's so sick. I mean, you're honestly wondering, like, could it be? Could you really lose her? Talking with her husband, can he really lose her? And as we're talking to her, she said, I have hope. The Lord knows the number of my days. I just want to live them out well. I'm sitting there looking at resurrection life, resurrection power, Christ in her. When Martha said, I know my brother will rise on resurrection day, Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. And I was looking at this friend of mine and seeing Jesus Christ, the resurrection and the life, bring her hope in what is otherwise a hopeless situation. When she did go see this doctor in Duke, by the way, as soon as she walked in, she had been meditating on Psalm 91. The last verse in Psalm 91 says this, "With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation." She was finding a lot of peace from that verse. Kind of strange, right? When it's like, apparently what's going to happen is your life's going to be shorter than you thought. But we connect this with resurrection, and that's not necessarily the case. But when she walks into this doctor, the doctor says, "Your disease can be managed for a long time." Whew. But this verse is true, even if she never got that news. Jesus Christ didn't have a long life. He lived to be what? 30, 33? Was this psalm true for him? Did he know this psalm? For sure. This psalm is true and brings hope. Because resurrection is our hope. And it's not just something that exists way out on some day. We live it now. Jesus did say a day is coming when all who are in their graves will hear my voice and come out. Resurrection day. But he also said this. A day is coming and has now come when all who hear my words and believe cross from death to life now. Resurrection is our hope too. Alex is going to come forward now and lead us in a song. A song that sings about carrying our cross, among other things. That as we follow Jesus and as we share the truth with the world around us, we will encounter pushback and grief. But never without hope, because resurrection is our hope now and forever.